Hey guys, welcome back to the Double Coverage Podcast, episode 3 with Johnny and Andrew Cassis.
What up, guys?
Just wanted to say before we get started, thank you to everybody who interacted with us on our social pages, who listened to both the first and second episodes on Anchor and SoundCloud. We really appreciate it, guys. We love to hear from you. Please go follow us on all those sites. Andrew, you want to go ahead and give them the socials?
Yeah, guys. Again, we're on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Anchor, like Johnny said. Everything at Double Coverage Sports Podcast. Find us there. Thanks again for checking us out. We're excited to be back for episode 3, and let's get this off on the right foot.
So on the show today, we're going to be leading off with Bryce Harper, who just signed the biggest contract in sports history.
Massive.
With the Philadelphia Phillies. 13 years, $330 million. So that's going to be a big topic we're going to be discussing today. Also going to look into some Kansas City Chiefs football. As you guys know, we're big Chiefs fans. Three big defensive players who are said to be on the move with the NFL Combine going on in Indianapolis. All the GMs and coaching staffs are there, so a lot of talk going on around the NFL, so we're going to get into some of that. After the football talk, we're going to be moving on to discuss the woeful weekend that our Los Angeles Lakers had. Going 0-2, losing to the Milwaukee Bucks in a hard-fought back-and-forth game, and then dropping a gimme to the Phoenix Suns in Phoenix last night. I was pretty ticked. So
that was kind of inexcusable. Yeah. We'll get into it.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. And then the last part of the show, we're going to be giving you ESPN came out with their top 25 under 25. So we took a look at that list. Some of it we agree with, a lot of it we don't. We're going to give you their top 10, give you our top 10, and let you know why we think the players are in the spots that we have them at. All right, so let's get it going, guys. Let's jump right
in. Wait. You forgot to mention one thing, Johnny.
Oh, boy.
Soccer? We got time for that today?
Again?
We have time for it, guys. I don't care what he says. We got time.
All right, I guess we can squeeze in a minute of soccer coverage. But before that, we're going to get into the Bryce Harper news. Andrew, you want to give the listeners some details on the Bryce Harper news?
Yeah, the most coveted free agent, Bryce Harper, over the last, 25 years in the MLB. There were three total deals signed last week. Nolan Arenado, third baseman for the Colorado Rockies, signed a 8-year, $260 million deal. Manny Machado was also signed last week. He's going to the Padres for 10 years, $300 million guaranteed. And, of course, Bryce Harper, he signed with the Phillies, 13 years, $330 million guaranteed. Just to kind of put that in perspective, guys, of how massive a deal this is and how much guaranteed money is on the books for Philly, Matthew Stafford, Matt Ryan, and Aaron Rodgers are the three highest paid players in the NFL right now. And combined, their guaranteed money is only $290 million. Combined. A single player in the MLB is getting $330 million. So, absolutely massive, which if you're a Phillies fan should probably come as no surprise. Phillies GM Matt Klentak last year, in an interview, said, "I have stupid amounts of money to spend on players, so maybe leaning towards getting somebody else." Bryce Harper and Mike Trout have been reportedly texting back and forth about the idea of playing with one another. And for those who don't know, Mike Trout will be a free agent in 2021 in 2 years. He comes off the book for the Angels. And during his introductory presser, Bryce Harper said, "I'm making $26 million a year. That's going to be able to bring some other guys in as well as build up this organization. There's another guy in about 2 years that comes off the books. We'll see what happens with that." It sounds like Bryce Harper is actively recruiting Mike Trout to come play for the Phillies with him. For those who don't know, Mike Trout is a Philadelphia native. You can constantly see him hanging out with Carson Wentz at Philadelphia Eagles games. He loves the city. He grew up there, and it wouldn't be much of a shock to see him make a jump to a different team. In an interview recently, Mike Trout also stated that he doesn't want to have contract negotiations with the Angels until after the next season. Which is definitely worth noting, guys, because the Bryce Harper contract gives the Phillies the flexibility that they need to go and pursue Mike Trout in 2 years. And Johnny's going to give you a little bit of the breakdown of this record 13-year deal that Bryce Harper just signed.
Yeah, so looking at the contract breakdown, Bryce Harper's going to be making $30 million in 2019, which is a big chunk of change. Then that number drops drastically to $26 million from 2022 to 2028. And then down another $4 million to $22 million from 2029 to 2031. So Bryce Harper is going to be making about $25.4 million annually. The reason why this contract is such a steal for the Phillies is that's not even top 10 in the league right now. So when you look at 13 years from now, that $22 million that he's going to be making towards the end of his contract is going to be almost nothing with the inflation and how much baseball players are making nowadays and how much the contracts have been going up year to year. The reason why Harper signed this deal is for long-term stability. That's really what he got paid for. If you ask me, it's not a contract. It's more of a marriage. 13 years is forever. He's not going to be up for a new deal until he's 39 years old. The other two interesting things about this contract is the fact that he has a no opt-out clause. So at no time during the contract is there a player or team option. So they are fully invested with each other for the 13 years. Harper also has a full no trade clause from the Phillies, which means he can't be traded. So even if the Phillies eventually want to move off on him, they can't do it unless he waives that no trade clause. So when I said this was a marriage, it really is a marriage. No opt-out, no trade. He's there for 13 years unless something drastically happens. As Andrew stated, Bryce Harper was one of the most highly coveted free agents to hit the MLB open market in quite some time, probably since A-Rod when he signed with the Yankees. So there were many teams that were trying to get on the Bryce Harper sweepstakes, and that includes our very own Los Angeles Dodgers. The Dodgers made a move this offseason to trade Yasiel Puig to the Cincinnati Reds, and it looked like that right field spot was wide open for Bryce Harper to slide in. The Dodgers offered Bryce Harper either a four-year, $172 million contract or a five-year, $215 million contract. When you break that down, that equates to about $43 million annually. And as you remember, I stated earlier that he's only averaging $25 million right now in the current contract with the Phillies. Now, the reason why this contract, in my opinion, was so much better for Bryce Harper is that this 4 or 5 year deal, at the end of it, he would have only been 29 or 30 years old. So as long as his play continued to progress the way it has and his consistency stayed the same, he'd be looking at another big payday at 29 or 30 years old. And that's where a lot of people sign big deals at that age, like Albert Pujols. Again, I mentioned Alex Rodriguez. So I believe he missed out on a big time opportunity to hit the free agent market twice. Once this year, and then again in a couple years if he had taken that shorter-term deal with the Dodgers or another team. So the reason why I believe that Bryce Harper didn't take the shorter-term deal with another team is in part because of his agent, Scott Boras. Scott Boras has signed 4 of the last 6 record-breaking contracts in any sports history. They've all been in baseball because that's usually where he resides. But he gets a huge payday out of this. He's going to get $30 million as opposed to him only getting $15 if he would have signed something with the Dodgers for a shorter-term deal like that. So I believe that Scott Boras had something to say in terms of making sure Bryce Harper got that long-term deal. He said that the last 3 years were hard to get out of the Phillies, hard to coax out of them for that extra $30 million.
So pretty safe to say, guys, that Scott Boras was the big winner in Bryce Harper signing this deal with the Phillies. Johnny, I know you had a couple more winners from the MLB offseason you wanted to touch on. You want to get into that?
Yeah, so somebody we already touched on was Mike Trout. He's going to be a free agent in a couple years, has largely been considered the best player in the MLB for the last 4 or 5 years, and he's only 26. So he's going to be looking at a big payday, and he's going to get paid. They're estimating he's going to get almost $400 million by the time he hits the free agent market. So that's huge. My other big winner is actually somebody who signed a couple of days before Bryce, is Manny Machado. I think Manny Machado got the best deal of the offseason. He gets 10 years, $300 million. It's fully guaranteed, but the thing that I love about Machado is he got that opt-out clause after 6.
Big.
So he's going to still be about 31 when that opt-out comes, if he so decides to get out of it. If not, he's getting paid $30 million straight across for 10 years. So there's no drop-off like the Bryce Harper deal. He will literally, for the next 10 years, be getting a $30 million salary to play baseball for the San Diego Padres. And the last winner for me is the Philadelphia Phillies. Went and got Bryce Harper, loaded with young talent. They're going to have more than enough room in a couple years to make a run at Mike Trout. Also, don't forget this offseason, the Phillies also signed Jean Segura and former NL MVP Andrew McCutchen to bolster that outfield. Phillies fans are obviously very excited. The Phillies sold over 100,000 tickets in just the 24 hours after the Bryce Harper signing.
The Phillies are definitely going to be tied up in a lot of big contracts in the coming years. Moving on to a team who's kind of in the middle of two big lucrative contracts, the Kansas City Chiefs. The Chiefs have a lot of money tied up on the defensive side of the ball, most notably Justin Houston and Eric Berry, two players who haven't been able to see the field as much as they or the Chiefs would have liked them to see over the last couple seasons, kind of starting with Eric Berry. In 2014, he had the whole lymphoma scare, was diagnosed with cancer, put him out for about almost a year and a half, came back, was able to play a full season, signed his lucrative deal, and then the first game that following season, tore his Achilles. So very unfortunate for him. He's dealt with a lot of stuff that has kept him off the field. And now another lingering problem that the Chiefs have been monitoring, a lot of Chiefs fans, the bone spur, which is essentially a Haglund's deformity is what they're calling it. It's a bone spur that digs into the Achilles tendon. David Chow, former medical doctor in the NFL, kind of took a look at this injury and talked about why surgery is not necessarily necessary for this injury, but it's something that we should monitor. So basically, Chiefs fans should just trust those in Eric Berry's camp and trust the Kansas City Chiefs team doctors that they'll be able to manage this injury moving forward because they feel confident enough that surgery is no longer an option for him. With Eric Berry missing a lot of time last season, there's been a lot of rumblings around the NFL about the Chiefs possibly moving on from him. I don't think that's too great of an idea. Johnny, did you have any thoughts about maybe why that's not too good of an idea? Or
so, yeah, going back to what you were saying a little bit, Eric Berry not needing surgery is huge. He's not been able to take part in off-season training camp or off-season activities for a couple of years now, so it would be really nice to see him get acclimated with the organization and with the players. Unfortunately, the two replacements that I see at safety are just not feasible. When you take a look at the free agent market, especially at the safety position, Landon Collins is one that jumps off the screen. He's a really athletic player, played with Steve Spagnuolo in that 4-3 defensive scheme with the Giants. Unfortunately, I think he's just going to warrant too much money. We already have Eric Berry tied up. We're going to get into Justin Houston later. We're going to have a lot of people to pay coming up soon with Chris Jones, Tyreek Hill, all those guys, Patty, who is going to need a new contract. So I just don't see Landon Collins being a fit financially. And that's the same thing with Earl Thomas, who's another big name. The Chiefs looked to trade for him last season before he broke his leg with the Seahawks and then flipped off the whole sideline. Don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, that was kind of kind of funny, honestly.
That was pretty comical.
Yeah.
Earl Thomas isn't even giving the Dallas Cowboys, who are his hometown team, a discount. He's looking for $13 million a year. So if the Chiefs did decide to make a move with Eric Berry, either releasing him as a post-June 1 cut designation and then go signing one of these guys, when you add up the dead money from Eric Berry's contract, then add in the new money from one of these new safeties contracts, it's going to end up adding up against the salary cap. And the last thing you want to do, especially in the NFL, which is such a salary cap heavy league, is have dead cap money for a player who you have no longer on your roster. Another huge contract the Chiefs may be looking to get out from under is that of Justin Houston, who signed a huge six-year, $100 million contract at the end of the 2014 season where he had 22 sacks. Andrew, what have you heard out of the combine about maybe the Chiefs getting a move on from Justin Houston?
So, I mean, the Chiefs full and well expect him to be back for this upcoming season, but they're not discounting the fact that they've heard trade talks and he's possibly been listed as a cut candidate. If he's cut before June 1st, they can save a little bit of money. If they keep him on the roster past then you're looking at a lot of dead money like you mentioned before, and most NFL teams are trying to avoid that dead money hit because it really affects their roster and who they can bring in afterwards. A little note on him, we wonder if he can stay healthy for a full year. Since 2014, he hasn't played a full season. Mm-hmm. And since that 22-sack season, he hasn't accumulated more than 10 sacks. So a lot of money going towards a guy who's not really giving us a lot of production and not really giving us a lot of time on the field. He's only played, the most he played was, I think, 14 games in 2016. One way the Chiefs can really open up their cap space this offseason, if they're able to trade Justin Houston and then do a release of Eric Berry post June 1st deadline, like you mentioned before, they'll be able to double their salary cap from $27 million that it's currently sitting at to around $50 million. So a lot more money to work with and possibly some new faces we'll see on the defensive side of the ball.
One of those new faces that Andrew mentioned is our new defensive coordinator, Steve Spagnuolo, came out of the Giants organization. He's going to come in and he's going to totally change this defense from a 3-4 scheme to a traditional 4-3, four down lineman, three linebacker scheme. And that does not bode well for Justin Houston. He is a traditional 3-4 outside rusher. He did play with his hand in the ground at Georgia in college. But since we drafted Justin Houston with the Kansas City Chiefs, we have been a 3-4 system, a 3-4 scheme, and that's what he has really hung his hat on, was being able to get pressure on the outside, use his leverage to get around those tackles, put pressure on the quarterback, and set a hard edge. Now, when we move to this 4-3 scheme, we're going to be needing him to do more gap run responsibility, as Steve Spagnuolo would probably be asking him to transition into a defensive end and play more 3-tech inside the tackle position. Moving right along with Kansas City Chiefs edge rushers is Dee Ford, outside linebacker for the Kansas City Chiefs, in his fifth year out of Auburn. He was franchise tagged by the Chiefs a couple of days ago, so he is currently on a one-year, $15.4 million contract for this coming season.
Kind of surprising coming out of the combine this weekend. The Chiefs have been approached by several teams looking to trade for the Pro Bowl linebacker. The Chiefs aren't actively shopping him, but with the new scheme on defense, he'll have to transition back to a 4-3 defender, rather the outside linebacker position he was playing in our previous 3-4 scheme. During his college days at Auburn, he was able to play the 4-3 pretty good. He'll just have to put on some weight. He'll be required to stop the run a little bit more, which, as we know as Chiefs fans, he struggled a little bit. But if he can accomplish that, I think the Chiefs will be happy to have him back. but don't rule out the possibility of a trade this offseason.
D Ford really made a splash this last season. He finished as PFF's number one rated edge rusher. He also finished with a league leading 7 forced fumbles, 55 tackles, and 13 sacks. As us Chiefs fans know, and I'm sure most NFL fans probably know now, he is most famous for lining up offside.
Don't bring that up, man. Come on.
I have to, dude. Don't bring it up. I would cut him just for that, I'm telling you right now.
That's a little harsh.
Lined up offsides in the AFC Championship game on the play in the fourth quarter where we intercepted Tom Brady. Game was over.
We won the game!
I was down the street running. Down the street, I was so excited just to come back and find out that he lined up offsides. And it wasn't even close. I mean, he was offside by a mile.
About half his body.
And then the week after, in the Pro Bowl, he's offsides again in the Pro Bowl. Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Not a good look for him there.
So, again, D Ford, I would just trade him because of that. I'm being honest. So, continuing with the theme of tragic letdowns, we're going to get into some Laker coverage. Everybody hold your breath, because this weekend was not pretty for the Lake Show. 0-2, losing Friday night to Milwaukee, then another loss against Phoenix.
Inexcusable.
Saturday night. So we're going to be getting into that right now. Friday night, the Lakers lost 131-120 at home against the number one seed in the Eastern Conference, the Milwaukee Bucks, dropping their record post-All-Star break to 2-3. So after that game, they were 30-32, 10th place in the West, 3.5 back of the Spurs for the last playoff spot, 4 back of the Kings for the 7th seed. At the time, they were 3-7 in their last 10, which is not very good, especially for a team looking to make that late-season playoff push and try and get into the playoffs. Unfortunately, it looks like the Lakers are crawling to the finish line rather than running. A big reason for their issues so far post-All-Star break has been their bench. Andrew, do you want to get into a little bit about their bench?
Yeah, so including Friday night's loss to Milwaukee, in the last 5 games, the Lakers' bench has been outscored 166-84. And midweek against Memphis only scored 5 points from the bench. That is it.
No,
okay.
That's not good.
They are averaging 16.8 bench points per game over the last 5 and have allowed almost 34 to opposing teams. So not the winning formula, guys. We need to get more production from the bench players as the starters play heavy minutes.
Yeah, the bench has been a huge problem. We've been getting good production from LeBron, from Kuz, from BI, so it's sad to see that the bench has not been able to hold up their end of the bargain. Me, personally, I'm looking right at Luke Walton, and I'm looking right at a play at the end of that Milwaukee game, down 121-118, Lakers have the ball, we just called a timeout. KCP is inbounding the ball, and the Bucks press. Okay, I don't know how the Lakers don't have some emergency press break play, but apparently we don't. Apparently that emergency press break is to throw the ball up to LeBron, who's being Oreo'd, double covered. KCP just throws the ball up. The ball gets tipped, ends up in the hands of Tony Snell. Tony Snell passes it to Malcolm Brogdon in the corner, who nails a 3 to put the lead up 6. And then we get another timeout by the Lakers. After the game, Luke Walton was asked about the play. He says, "I'll take responsibility. We call the timeout to get a play to LeBron coming downhill. I took for granted that we'd get the ball inbound. That's on me." So the head coach of our Los Angeles Lakers took for granted the most important part of inbounding the ball, which is getting the ball inbound. He later went on to say in the press conference, "We had an extra timeout. We've got to take it. We can't afford to turn the ball over right there. But they came up and pressed, and we didn't get open, and at that point, we probably should have just called the timeout. I know guys always want to save them, but it was a costly play in the game." Well, Luke, I'm pretty sure the coach can call a timeout. So the fact that you knew you had a timeout and saw that the 5-second violation was coming fast, and instead of having KCP just throw it up in such an important situation, we could have called that timeout. So I don't know how you somehow spun this to say guys always want to save them, but you're the guy. You are the head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, and that timeout needs to come from you, okay? Sorry LeBron can't do everything, and he's getting double-teamed, and you want him to call a timeout. Sorry that we ask you to do something as simple as understand substitution rotations and call timeouts at pivotal points in the game. I guess that's asking too much. I don't know.
So kind of picking up where Johnny left off on the issue with substitution rotations, Luke Walton put out a lineup that we hadn't seen before, a lineup of Mike Muscala, Rajon Rondo, Kyle Kuzma, KCP, which Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, sorry about that, and Josh Hart. Twice in the game he did that. The first time they were out there in the first half, they were outscored 8-2 in a 1 minute and 50 second stretch of game time. And then again, we tried this lineup again when we're down trying to mount a comeback against the Bucks at the beginning of the fourth quarter with the same lineup and got outscored 7-2, this time in only a minute and 15 of game time. So collectively, that group of substitutions he put out were a combined minus 11 in 3 minutes and 5 seconds of total game time. But hey, I guess there's one selling point. Josh Hart finally hit a three for the first time since January.
And those Lakers struggles just continued to mount as we went on the second night of a back-to-back. Saturday night in Phoenix, the Lakers go and lose 118-109 to the Phoenix Suns. At one point, they were down 17 points. Andrew, you were actually able to watch the whole game live, so what are a couple of your thoughts on what happened that day?
I mean, first of all, the outcome is just pathetic, to be honest, to be straightforward. It's just an inexcusable game to drop. When it comes down to what happened on the court, the effort level, if you guys saw the game, the effort level of the team is just beyond pitiful at this point. The Lakers' on-ball defense this season has been just completely atrocious, and we're again on display Saturday night in Phoenix. The Lakers are constantly getting beat off the dribble, which is causing breakdowns on the back end of the defense. And one more thing that they've been just completely awful at this entire season, rebounding. We allow a lot of second-chance opportunities, which end up allowing a lot of easy buckets for the opposing team.
Yeah, the Lakers over the last two games had plenty of opportunities to go ahead and get these two wins. And LeBron James mentioned that in the post-game presser, said it's unfortunate with the opportunities we've had that we haven't been able to seize him. As a collective group, we just didn't have it tonight, talking about the game in Phoenix Saturday night. Unfortunately, that's just not going to cut it anymore. I don't know what it's going to take for the Laker players, the Laker staff, to understand the sense of urgency that's going on. I know that Luke had stated that they don't talk about it all that much, but everybody's aware of it. Well, maybe they need to start talking about it, because it's getting down the home stretch here. The Lakers are not in a position to where they are going to make the playoffs. They have less than a 4% chance now, based on ESPN's BPI, to make the playoffs. And I know a big point for LeBron haters, and especially Lakers fans that aren't happy about the move for LeBron to come here, are going to point out the two missed free throws that he had, down by three. Over the last two games against Milwaukee, he played 39 minutes. And then on the second night of a back-to-back, he played 41 minutes Saturday night. So, yeah, he missed two free throws. He also had 27, 16, and 8. So I don't know what you guys expect when he says playoff mode activated. I guess that's not enough. But 27, 16, and 8 is absolutely absurd. That's not happening from pretty much anybody in the league, not named LeBron, James Harden, or Paul George right now. So another quick news with the Lake Show. The Lonzo Ball was reevaluated. He is progressing. It just doesn't look like he's ready to play now. He is going to be reevaluated again on Thursday, so hoping he can come back soon. The Lakers really need him, especially on that defensive side of the ball, and to give them another playmaker. Right now, they don't really have a playmaker besides LeBron James, and I guess if you kind of want to call Brandon Ingram a playmaker, I think of Kyle Kuzma more as a shot maker and a shot taker. So getting Lonzo Ball back in the lineup to help facilitate the offense when LeBron's not on the court, be able to get people some open shots, and a big thing that nobody really talks about with Lonzo is just his ability to outlet the ball. He's not looking to pass to a certain person. He's looking to pass to the open person. And he's always looking to push the floor and push the tempo, which is where this Lakers team seems to be at its best.
I know for Lakers fans, it's difficult right now to have bright spots at this point of the season when we're dropping such pivotal games towards a playoff push. But Brandon Ingram, you know, continues to just shine since the All-Star break, still averaging over 28 points a game, 7 rebounds, 3 assists, all while shooting 60% from the field. ESPN just released their list of top 25 players under 25, and surprisingly, Ingram didn't find himself on that list. So right now, we're actually just going to take the top 10 from that list, give you our top 10, and why they belong in the spots that they do.
So we are going to be starting off with number 10 on ESPN's top 25 under 25, Devin Booker. My number 10 is also Devin Booker. I've told Andrew since his college days at Kentucky when he was coming off the bench that this guy was going to be special. He's averaging 25, 4, and 7 this year, and this really has proved his playmaking ability since he entered the league when he was considered more of a 3 and D guy.
Number 10 for me is Pascal Siakam. Siakam has seemingly come out of nowhere this season with his production skyrocketing. He's super lengthy, he's a great on-ball defender, excellent in transition, and he has proven himself to be a very nice complimentary player alongside Kawhi Leonard.
Moving on to number 9, ESPN has De'Aaron Fox. My number 9 is D'Angelo Russell. It was tough to see D'Angelo leave LA with how much talent he has, but the move was welcome for me. It got rid of the Timothy Mozgov contract, and without that contract move, we would not have LeBron James. This year, he's averaging 21, 4, and 7, and most importantly, he has the Brooklyn Nets sitting at number 6 in the Eastern Conference right now.
Number 9 on my list is Jason Tatum. Jason Tatum has proven to be an effective on-ball defender and can knock down the three ball with great efficiency. Look for his production to rise in year 3 when his usage rate rises and he becomes the focal point of the Celtics offense.
Number 8 on ESPN's list is Jason Tatum. Number 8 on my list is Donovan Mitchell. Donovan Mitchell was a huge find for the Jazz. He's their key playmaker. I personally feel he's a little overrated. I could easily put D'Lo over him, but given the production he's had the last couple years, have to put him at number 8.
Number 8 for me as well is Donovan Mitchell. I mean, this guy is just a pure scorer. He can shoot the three ball, he'll dunk it in your face, he'll get to the paint. He's sneaky athletic for his size at only 6'3".
The spider.
In my opinion, he's kind of small to play the shooting guard position that he's currently playing. He's at his best playing the point guard role. Earlier in the season, he averaged 31 points a game from the point guard spot. So look to see him play more point guard as his career moves forward.
Number 7 on ESPN's list is Donovan Mitchell. Number 7 on my list is Jason Tatum. Jason Tatum's numbers don't back up his talent at all. He's a no-doubt scorer, super skilled on the offensive end, and in a different situation, as Andrew said, with a higher usage rate and less mouths to feed, he's going to excel and score 20 points in this league in his sleep.
Number 7 on my list is D'Angelo Russell. I have D'Angelo Russell a little bit higher on my list than Johnny did because of his ability to hit clutch shots and knock down the three ball. As Johnny mentioned before, he currently has the Brooklyn Nets at 6th place in the Eastern Conference. Look for them to make some noise in the playoffs with D'Angelo Russell leading the charge.
Number 6 on ESPN's list is Luka Doncic. Number 6 on my list is also Luka Doncic. The 20-year-old rookie has absolutely set the league on fire, averaging 21, 7, and 6 in his debut season. Fun fact, he says it's easier to score in the NBA than in the EuroLeague, so he's got that going for him. One thing that I would watch for Luka Doncic, though, is he does have a 29% usage rate, so that's extremely high. Guys like James Harden, LeBron James, those are the guys you normally see hovering around that area. So Luka is definitely someone to keep your eye on as he progresses through this league.
Number 6 on my list is Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons has already established himself as one of the best players in the NBA in transition. Getting to the basket is easy for him, and he scores most of his points at the cup. He already has elite court vision and awareness. The one thing he will need to improve on moving forward is his outside game and his free throw percentage. But Ben Simmons is a star born in this league and will be for years to come.
Number 5 on ESPN's list is Ben Simmons. Number 5 on my list is Nikola Jokic. The center out of Denver is having a breakout year, averaging 20 points, 11 rebounds, and almost 8 assists. Unfortunately, he's not a big factor defensively as he's more of a liability. He struggles with his lateral quickness, which causes problems with him defending the rim and coming out on high pick and rolls. But he is an amazing passer, especially for a center, probably the best in the league in terms of distributing to his teammates.
Number 5 on my list is Luka Doncic. As Johnny might already know, Luka Doncic has quickly become one of my favorite players in the NBA to watch.
Yeah, I know.
He's smooth all over the court. He can knock down shots. His shot-making ability is absolutely insane. If you see any of his games, he's knocking down from the corner. He's only 19 and already averaging 20 points per game in the NBA. Look for him to just excel in this league as the future moves on with Luka Doncic.
Number 4 on ESPN's list is Karl-Anthony Towns. Number 4 on my list is Ben Simmons. The 6'10 point guard from Philly is averaging 17, 9, and 8 this season. As Andrew has already mentioned, he does need to improve his shooting ability. But there are people who came in just like Magic who really had questionable jumpers. LeBron was one of those people too. And I believe as time goes on and he gets through this league, they're going to work with him and help progress that jump shot. And once he does, he's going to be unstoppable in this league.
Number 4 on my list is Karl-Anthony Towns. Karl-Anthony Towns has already emerged as one of the best three-point shooting big men in the NBA, shooting it at a rate of 40% per game. He's great on the low block. His footwork under the basket is helping him get a lot of easy buckets. One thing I would like to see him do a lot more, though, he only shoots 5 free throws a game, so maybe that number could go up a little bit and help boost his scoring output. But Karl-Anthony Towns will be a dominant force in the NBA for many years to come.
Number 3 on ESPN's list is Nikola Jokic. Number 3 on my list is Karl-Anthony Towns. Carl Anthony Towns is averaging 24, 12, and 3 this year. He's highly skilled on the block and in space. And as Andrew said, he can stretch the defense by really knocking down the three ball to help space the floor for those slashers and those drivers that they have over there in Minnesota.
Number 3 on my list is Joel Embiid. After missing the first 2 full seasons of his career, Joel Embiid has emerged in the NBA to be a dominant force. He ranks first in the NBA this season in defensive rebounds, and he is 7th in the league in blocks. His scoring output of 27 points per game is kind of unseen for a guy his size. He's a 7-footer with the skills of a 2-guard. He can knock down the 3 on a regular basis, and the Philadelphia Sixers hope that they can keep him healthy and he can have a long career with them.
Number 2 on ESPN's rankings is Joel Embiid. Number 2 on my list is also Joel Embiid. As Andrew has stated, injury history is really the only plague for Joel. When healthy, he is one of the most dominant centers in the game. Unfortunately, like we've said, that is not always the case. Right now, he's actually currently hurt again with knee soreness and back tightness, keeping him out. On the bright side, he is averaging a career high almost 35 minutes a game when he does play. So that's a bright side to look out for if you're a Philadelphia Sixer fan or a front office member.
Number 2 on my list is Nikola Jokic. The Denver center might not be a household name just yet, but look out for him in the years to come. Nikola Jokic has developed his game as an incredible passer, as Johnny mentioned before. He's also able to stretch the defense by knocking down 3-pointers on a regular basis and can also get to the rim and get easy buckets when needed.
And number 1 on the list for ESPN, my list, and Andrew's list, kind of a no-brainer here, is Giannis Antetokounmpo. Giannis is my MVP this season as he currently has the Bucks at number 1 atop the Eastern Conference. When he decides to go to the rim, this guy cannot be stopped. When he finally starts consistently knocking down jump shots, he's going to absolutely wreck this league more than he already is.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's an absolute force of nature, man. He's just unbelievable in the open court, going to the basket like you mentioned. And I don't know if you see, but his offhand dunking, he's right-handed, but he dunks harder with his left hand sometimes. And honestly, it's kind of scary. I'm almost worried for the guy underneath the basket getting posterized by the guy we know is the Greek Freak. Like Johnny said, develop the jumper, he's unstoppable.
Now time for everybody's favorite part of the show.
Yes.
And by everybody, I mean Andrew. It is time for soccer.
It's going to be the listener's favorite part of the show too, Johnny.
Yeah.
Watch. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. So, covering Premier League and we're covering El Clasico, which was this weekend, guys. So, top 4 teams in the Premier League all played this weekend. Manchester City went top of the table with a 1-0 win versus Bournemouth. Liverpool had a chance to retake the top spot in the division, but after playing to a scoreless draw against Everton, they remain in second place for now. Tottenham in third place and Arsenal played to a 1-1 draw on Saturday. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang for Arsenal missed what would have been a game-winning penalty kick in stoppage time, which would have dropped Tottenham down to fourth. Manchester United, fourth place right now, secured a late winner versus Southampton to put them into the top 4, into a Champions League qualifying spot after a 3-2 win against them. Manchester United find themselves in a Champions League spot for the first time since releasing Jose Mourinho and hiring Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And lastly from this weekend, if you missed it, El Clasico took place, which is Barcelona versus Real Madrid. Barcelona has absolutely dominated Madrid this season. They secured their second win in Madrid in the last 4 days this week, courtesy of an Ivan Rakitic winner in a 1-0 win versus Real Madrid. They've gone 12 points clear on top of the league table past Real Madrid, and they are now 10 points clear of Atletico Madrid in the La Liga standings. In 4 games this season against Real Madrid, Barcelona has 3 wins, 1 draw. They have scored 10 goals in this game and have only conceded 2 against Real Madrid, who have really struggled this season to replace the production of Cristiano Ronaldo, who is now lighting it up in Italy. And that's a wrap. Boom. Soccer coverage. Over, Johnny.
Yeah, thankfully.
One too long. Not too bad.
Yeah, I didn't understand anything except Barcelona and Real Madrid. So that's going to do it for today, guys. Just wanted to thank everybody who joined us today and listened to the podcast. We really appreciate it. Again, guys, we're new at this, so if you have any recommendations, any comments, any suggestions, anything we're not covering that you might want to hear, you can hit us up on all of our socials. Andrew, you want to drop those?
Again, Double Coverage Sports Podcast, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Anchor, SoundCloud. 5 different platforms, guys. You can reach us all there. Drop a like, drop a follow. Appreciate you guys having us in. Oh, MLS is back, by the way. Just had to throw that one in there. But yeah, thanks for tuning in, guys. We will see you on episode 4.